The following is a repeat broadcast of the Global Research News Hour, which originally aired January 12, 2018. Why should the Cuban people and their supporters be cautious about the normalizations of relations between Cuba and the United States started under President Obama? What Trojan horse strategies are being used to subvert the Cuban Revolution from within? Is Trump likely to alter the revisioning of the U.S.-Cuban relationship initiated under Obama? What is the Hans Seidel Foundation and what role did it play in an October 2015 conference situated in the island nation? How does the co-opting of the Cuban intelligentsia further America's soft coup of the country's revolutionary project? On this week's Global Research News Hour, we probe the U.S. government's rapprochement with Cuba in recent years and assess whether the reboot of the relationship represents an opportunity or a threat to the Cuban people. We'll speak to Arnold August, a Cuba scholar and author of a recent book on the subject. We'll also speak with Michel Chosadovsky of the Center for Research on Globalization about his experience with a conference financed by a German NGO aligned with U.S. imperial interests. On today's program, Obama's Trojan Horse, America's Cuban Soft Coup. Bringing you the analysis beyond the media headlines, the Global Research News Hour is on the air. Welcome to the Global Research News Hour for the week of January 12, 2018. I'm series host and producer Michael Welch. The Global Research News Hour is a special radio collaboration between the Center for Research on Globalization and campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg on occupied Anishinaabe territory and the homeland of the Métis Nation. We seek to provide you with access to analysis of the major issues shaping our world today from thinkers, researchers, and unique political personalities rarely addressed by major media. Our program is available from the Center's website, globalresearch.ca. We can also be heard on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. We'll begin our show with News Notes, a sampling of articles from the Global Research News site. While some nuclear powers have ruled out ever launching a first strike, the U.S. has long refused to make such a position, with President Obama's brief consideration of such a pledge quickly panned as making the U.S. look weak. Even without the pledge, the current crop of arms are for all intents and purposes unusable except in an extinction-level nuclear exchange. Such a strike would simply be too big and too much of a humanitarian disaster to seriously contemplate, which is where these smaller nuclear arms come in. Pentagon officials see the introduction of more tactical nuclear arms as a way to build arms that are usable at a much lower threshold and seem to be shrugging off concerns that this will effectively normalize nuclear warfare. That comes from the article, Trump Administration Prepares More Hawkish Position on Nuclear Arms, the Deployment of Mini-Nukes, by Jason Ditz. Post January 11th, originally appearing at antiwar.com. Military intelligence is almost always directed against foreign targets, and there are multiple ways to describe the practice of this art, but the most relevant one is to draw attention to a four-step process that, interestingly, begins and ends with democracy. The first step is to develop concepts that can serve to widen societal divisions, second step, that provoke a crisis, third step, and allow for the implementation of reverse-engineered endgame solutions, final step. While there are many theories that can catalyze the sequence and conclude it, regardless of whether they're the same for fulfilling both roles or are different, democracy is the same effective for killing two birds with one stone. Part of the universal appeal for democracy is that people believe that it's the best way to hold decision makers accountable in ensuring that they fulfill their promises to increase the living standards for the general population and empower individuals to actualize their full potential. Democracy, however, is also the proverbial Pandora's box, and there's no going back once the ideals of this theory have either been introduced or practiced in a society. That comes from the article, U.S. Military Intelligence Has Weaponized Democracy Worldwide, by Andrew Korybko, posted January 11th, originally appearing at Oriental Review. The increase in the number of U.S. troops is not to secure the country or annihilate the U.S. creations, the Taliban and ISIS, but rather a show of U.S. power to rivals Russia, China, and Iran. The reinforcement of air power under the new strategy killed tens of civilians in blind bombardments carried out by the criminal U.S. Army in several parts of Afghanistan in just a few weeks. The only people cheering for this new strategy are heads of the mafia puppet government of Afghanistan and their intellectual lackeys, because their master has decided to elongate their ominous lives by extending its stay in our country. We should not be deceived by the U.S.'s pressure on Pakistan either. The history of the U.S. and Pakistan go back decades, when the filthy government and terrorist fostering army of Pakistan trained and exported the most bloodthirsty and reactionary groups to our country in accordance with the orders and dollars of the White House. That was an excerpt of an interview conducted by Edu Montesanti with Freeba, a representative of the Revolutionary Association of Women of Afghanistan, appearing under the headline, U.S. Needs the Taliban to Justify Its Military Presence in Afghanistan, posted January 11th. I have just read through the new United States National Security Strategy released by President Trump in December 2017. There have been many comments on it, most of them focusing on the hostility in the document towards Russia and China, but also some question of what the strategy is. Well, after reading page after page of delusions, bombast, bragging, bullying, lies, fantasies, and deep-seated megalomania, you discover that there is no strategy. They don't have one. The only use that document has is as irrefutable evidence that the government of the United States is what they like to call a joint criminal enterprise intent on seizing control of the world for its sole interests. That comes from the article, Trump's National Security Strategy, or NSS, War and More War, by Christopher Black, posted January 10th, originally appearing at New Eastern Outlook. These are just a few of the featured articles appearing last week on the Global Research website. Regular visitors to the site are encouraged to send monetary contributions by fax, mail, or online. Just go to globalresearch.ca and click Donate on the menu bar. For more than 20 years, Arnold August has traveled to Cuba for extensive periods as part of his investigative research into the Latin American country. He's an accomplished journalist with an MA earned at McGill University in Montreal, where he is based. He's the author of the 2013 book, Cuba and Its Neighborhoods, Democracy in Motion, published by Fernwood Publishing and Zed Books. And on Thursday, January 18th, he will be speaking in Winnipeg at McNally Robinson Booksellers on Grant Avenue to launch his latest book, Cuba, U.S. Relations, Obama and Beyond, also published by Fernwood. Arnold August, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure.
Okay. So your book, your latest book mostly explores this supposed watershed in relations between the U.S. and Cuba around the pivotal date, December 17th, 2014, or 17D, as it is referred to, when President Obama and President Raul Castro jointly announced a normalization of relations, in spite of welcoming the development as a positive step. You present it as the latest front in a new U.S. incursion into the country. When did you begin to smell something rotten, that things aren't quite as optimistic as they're being presented?
Okay, that's an interesting question. In fact, just to put this in context, I did welcome it as a very positive step. For example, it's the first time in over 50 years that the U.S. and Cuba have established diplomatic relations. And as well, as you recall, there was a very important event that day, that the remaining Cuban five who were in prison at the time were returned home that very same day on December 17th. So I consider that to be a very positive step.
Well, so did I, actually.
Pardon?
I mean, in spite of whatever cynical elements.
Yeah, right. But at the same time, I do, as you say, with a lot of pride, I'm not ashamed at all in saying that, that I also see a very negative side. And you asked, when did I first begin to smell something rotten, I have to tell you, quite frankly, soon as Obama, or while Obama was speaking on December 17, 2014, I saw, you know, I saw what the negative thing was immediately. And, you know, probably similarly to you and other people who are listening, I follow U.S. politics quite a lot over a long period of time. And I'm familiar with the domestic politics, how the, you know, presidential candidates and the presidents act in the United States. And so I have this habit of reading very carefully what is said that specific day with the Obama statement, as well as several White House statements that were released on that day in 2014. Now, he said very clearly, Obama said very clearly, that he said that the Cuban policy before Obama was a failure. Now, he said that. It's true. Now, some of the media, mass media in various parts of the country, they jumped on that. He admitted that it's a failure. It would be wrong to say that he admitted it was a failure. You have to look at the sentences that come right after that in the document as well as in his actual speech, which we heard on that day. He said it was a failure because we did not succeed in bringing the changes to Cuba that we wanted to. That is to bring democracy to Cuba, to bring to make Cuba into a market economy. That is to abandon socialism and adopt a U.S. style economy, neoliberal economy. He also said it was a failure because our goal was to isolate Cuba, and instead of isolating Cuba, it was the United States who became isolated over the last few years. That is, the Latin American countries, all of them, opposed the U.S. blockade against Cuba, and they support Cuba's right to oppose the blockade and self-determination for Cuba. So the bottom line of this, Michael, is that the goal of Obama, and I read through it immediately on that specific day, that, well, it's time for us to change tactics. What we tried did not work, that is, did not reach the objective of subverting the Cuban Revolution. We have to take tactics, change tactics for new ones that will allow us to succeed in subverting the Cuban Revolution. So his basic change, the Obama change in policy, was one of the traditional U.S. Policy of aggressive comments, whether it's from the Bushes or the Clintons or others before him, to change from aggression to seduction. That is, instead of trying to subvert the Cuban Revolution from the outside, the goal was now to subvert the Cuban Revolution from the inside. And that, of course, was symbolized more clearly than anything else when Obama went to Havana in March 2016. So that was the basic change in the U.S. policy towards Cuba, as it was reflected in Obama's statement on that day.
Could you talk a little bit about, I mean, you were talking about, I guess you used the term Trojan horse in
yes.
this new strategy. And I'm wondering if you could talk about some of those tactics that's been opened up in the wake of this new detente. I mean, the U.S. seems to be hedging their bets that they can somehow infiltrate Cuban society and get people within, as you say, within Cuban society to internally reshape the system and overcome the objectives of the Revolution of 59. Our listeners are familiar with the National Endowment for Democracy and USAID and these other, CIA proxies, essentially, which, you know, promote quote-unquote democracy.
Well, it's very good that you educate your listeners on that. I think that, in my view, is one of the key points in international politics at this time.
So what is actually happening? I mean, some examples of what's actually happening and what's being executed in Cuba.
I could give you an example that took place not too long after Obama opened up this, what is called a thaw. You know, what kind of a thaw is it if they continue the democracy promotion programs in Cuba after the establishing diplomatic relations with Cuba with the goal of subverting the revolution. I can give you one very concrete example. If you have amongst your listener, if you have youth and students, in the fall of 2016, it became known in Cuba that the United States, through the USAID program, was recruiting some Cubans online who would be given bursaries, who would be given a special aid to go from Cuba to United States for education on how to become leaders in Cuba, how to bring about change in Cuba, of course, according to the U.S. version of what change means for Cuba. Now, this was uncovered by the Cuban students, and there was it provoked a lot of demonstrations and activities against this specific USAID program. And it was interesting that one of the people they actually recruited was a patriotic student, who, when he came back, he told a live audience on Cuban TV about what was happening when they were in the United States. And this is, you know, in conformity to what you mentioned with regards to USAID. They would get to the United States, and all of the program was about how good American democracy is, talking about the elections going on at that time, and how to become an appropriate leader in Cuba to bring about changes in Cuba. So this is a very, you know, an example of what we call trying to subvert the revolution from within. And this is, of course, made easier by the fact that Obama changed the tactics, and with a smile on his face, or the smile on the face of U.S. imperialism, tried to promote the subversion of democracy from within. And I think another point, if we could still dwell on the issue of Trojan horse, if you don't mind,
sure,
is that there's a lot of noise, you know, like, given the impression that, you know, Obama was a good guy, he tried to open up diplomatic relations with Cuba, which he did, but also with its negative impact, while Trump is so terrible. Of course, Trump is terrible, there's no doubt about it, but the point is that the Obama policy of subverting the revolution within is being carried out under Trump, with Trump not even being obliged to do anything towards that. It's sort of been handed on the platter to Trump. I'll give you a concrete example. When Obama visited Havana in March 2016, amongst his many activities there, he had a meeting with what are called, you know, small private entrepreneurs, small private business owners. Now, in that meeting, one of the people was the owner of a small T-shirt boutique or factory in Havana. And when Obama introduced her, he was very aware. He mentioned her by name. He said that he would like to buy T-shirts for himself and his daughters and all that. He made a big, you know, fuss about it the way he can with his Ivy League approach and personality and all that. And she, of course, spoke on the need to have United States American assistance in how to develop this type of small business. Now, of course, she later went on to study business at Harvard. So we could just imagine, or your listeners probably might ask, well, for a Cuban to go to Harvard to study business there, is this not in contradiction with the Cuban socialist system? Of course it is, but they do not seem to see any contradiction in that at all when they go to Harvard. Now, what is important, I think, in the context of all this fuss about Trump, is that about 2 weeks ago, the Miami Herald, which is, of course, very anti-Castro, based in that part of Florida, had an article featuring and promoting the owner of this T-shirt boutique, explaining how they're doing so well. They're even exporting the T-shirts to United States to sell there. And, you know, we can see it coming. They're becoming quite wealthy. But it's not so much the question of wealth, but the overall, when this person explains the goals of the T-shirts, it is obvious a goal to subvert the revolution. The name of the company that produces the T-shirts is called Clandestino, or Clandestine. So right off the bat, it gives you an idea that they consider themselves clandestine, or sort of a hidden or unhidden dissidents within the Cuban system. Now, this is nothing new, but what is of interest in my view, that this is taking place now while Trump is there. And so the basic new approach of Obama and its effects, such as these amongst these small businesses who are looking towards capitalism as a solution for Cuba, this is going on right now under the nose of Trump. So, you know, the basic policy of the United States towards Cuba to subvert the revolution, whether it's through charm, like Obama, or through pressure by Trump, the basic underlying thing is still going on regarding to try to get a section of Cuban society to distance themselves from the Cuban Revolution and look to the United States for a solution to problems that, in fact, exist in Cuba.
Now, there's popular depictions of Cuba in the mainstream media and elite institutions is that Cuba is not a democracy. It's a one-party state. They don't have freedom of the press. And this is maybe one of that plays to that whole idea you're discussing about, you know, sort of dividing the people. Could you maybe address these perceived shortcomings of the Cuban government and this offensive of the need to bring a U.S.-style democracy to the country?
Yeah. When it said, of course, perceived, you're very right in placing that in that context, that it's perceived by the United States. Like, I personally never compare one system to the other. My basic view is Cuba has its own political system that came out since 1959. In fact, it goes back to the second half of the 19th century. They have their own tradition, their own heritage when it comes to democracy, the participation of people in the political system, which is revolutionary. That is their system. And then the United States, we could be generous and say, well, the United States has their democracy. They have their way of doing things. Now, it's up to the United States and the people in the United States to bring about changes in the United States to make that system really democratic, which, of course, is a goal very far from being achieved. Now, to the same token, it's up to the Cuban people, especially the Cuban revolution, to bring about changes in Cuba to improve their political system, to improve their electoral system, not to change it so that it's in conformity with the U.S. preconceived views of how a political system should be. For example, when Obama was in Havana in March 2016, and he had the opportunity to speak to the Cuban nation on live TV, he said, well, there are differences. Cuba has a one-party system, and the United States has a multi-party democracy. So right off the bat, the word democracy, according to Obama and all U.S. presidents, including, of course, Trump, the word democracy is not fitting for Cuba, just by mentioning it that way, when, of course, ipso facto, United States is a democracy, irrespective of what people think. So this perception comes from the ruling circles in the United States from 1959 right to Obama, including, as well as Trump, of course. Now, Cubans are used to this tendency of being lectured regarding democracy and human rights and all that, and they're pretty immune to it in the sense that they say, sure, we know that there are problems in our system, but it's up to us to change it. I remember very well, if we have time, I'll give you one anecdote from the time when John Kerry visited Havana in August 2015 to raise the flag near the American embassy to symbolize the fact that the American embassy in Havana is being reopened once again. And his speech was quite diplomatic. It wasn't too bad. He said that what Cuba needs is genuine democracy. Now, right after that, there was a joint press conference held between, on the one hand, John Kerry and Bruno Rodriguez, who was the foreign minister of Cuba, the vis-a-vis of John Kerry, in which there was a question and answer period by the journalist present at the time, and one journalist from Associated Press, who was quite a good journalist, in fact, based in Havana, she asked Bruno Rodriguez, this thing about genuine democracy, what is your view about democracy in Cuba? And he gave a very simple, clear, and transparent answer. He said, well, I'm okay with a democracy in Cuba. Of course, it has to be improved as part of our striving to improve the social and economic system in Cuba. We have to improve it, but that's up to us. That's the way I feel. I agree with what he said. It's very well put. And I think that is really the issue, that each country has its own system, and in both cases, up to, in the Cuban case, to improve it, while I would say in the American case, it needs a revolutionary change to go from the type of system that exists now, which is very far from being democratic, to a system which in which people really have political power.
One of the things that came up in the book that I hadn't really reflected on much before was the role of bloggers in the development and the evolution of the political culture in Cuba, both in support of the revolutionary project and the dissidents. So I'm wondering if you could maybe comment a little bit on
that. Yes, of course. I think that's a very important point. In fact, in previous book events, this has been one of the main interests in which people have shown, and I will be dealing with this in more detail at the book event in Winnipeg next week. But just as a intro, I would say that in my book, what I present, I have chapter 3, which are interviews with 5 experts on Cuba-U.S. relations, experts based in Havana, and for the first time, an English-speaking audience has access to what they think with regards to U.S.-Cuba relations and the latest, what I call, you know, the latest adventure or incursion into Cuba that was initiated with the Obama new policy. And so what is not known is that, you know, people, when we look at the news, the media, they always, I guess your listeners are always also notice that, they always would mention some irrelevant dissident in Cuba and hold that person up as an icon of change in Cuba, etc. But I never see anyone mentioning these revolutionary bloggers, revolutionary writers in Cuba who have take a very strong stand against this new cultural incursion into Cuba led by the United States. And it's very interesting to see how they operate, what they write. Like, for example, when Obama was in Havana in March 2016 and he said various things that raised the eyebrows of many Cubans, these people wrote articles that very same night, and the next morning, those who follow their writings and read Spanish, we can see a very strong Cuban patriotic anti-imperialist position against Obama's pressure to change Cuba towards the type of system that he would want. So this is, I hope to be discussing this further next week at the book event, and also I definitely will go into what you raised here, the Trojan horse that is, it does exist in Cuba. I would be wrong to say, oh no, they didn't succeed. Obama did succeed. It's very concrete evidence that concrete people, I gave you one example of the t-shirt boutique owner, that it actually exists in Cuba, and I would like to go into that in some detail next week, how this new example, or this example of a Trojan horse, also exists under the Trump government, who, in my view, is just riding the coattails of the Obama policy with regard to this incursion into Cuba.
Well, Arnold August, I think we've given listeners here in Winnipeg a good taste of what you'll be talking about, and they may be compelled to come out and see you, or better still, purchase the book.
Yes, right.
Cuba-U.S. Relations, Obama and Beyond by Arnold August. And again, the date of that event is Thursday, January 18th at 7 p.m. in McNally Robinson Booksellers on Grant Avenue. Arnold August, thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
And Arnold August joins us from Montreal, and he is also a frequent contributor to the Global Research website. You're listening to the Global Research News Hour, broadcast out of Winnipeg on campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM and on the Progressive Radio Network at PRN.FM. We are also podcast on the website globalresearch.ca. So we're joined right now by Professor Michelle Chosadovsky, founder and director of the Center for Research on Globalization. And we're discussing the topic of Cuba and the co-optation of Cuban intellectuals. So, Professor Chosadovsky, right in March of last year, you'd written an article addressing that specific point. I was wondering if you could maybe elaborate a little bit more on the threat you see there, because we've been there was. Supposedly a lot of good news when Barack Obama had gone in there and indicated that there was going to be a change in tack in terms of, how we approach the situation in Cuba. But I'm sure you would agree that this is not so much this normalization of relations between the two countries is not necessarily something that, people in solidarity with the Cuban the People's Movement and the Castro Revolution should feel good about?
Well, let me just put this in context. I think that certainly under the Trump administration, and he's made very firm declarations to that effect, that there is a regime change agenda which is currently contemplated by Washington policymakers. That's absolutely clear. And the Trump administration has been categorical. I don't think that this is necessarily different to what Obama would have done. Obama is just as much a figurehead as Trump. But, of course, Obama projects at least a vision of dialogue and exchange, which, of course, Trump doesn't have, particularly with regard to Cuba. And Trump, during his election campaign, had already committed himself to reversing Obama's policy directive, which was one of normalization. Now, let me put this in context. My distinct impression from my last visit to Cuba, which was 2 years ago, when I was invited by a think tank, research center associated with the Ministry of Foreign Affairs to discuss and debate issues of transition. I think that what Washington is preparing is what I might describe as a soft coup. It comes from within. It's based on infiltration, co-optation. And there are various mechanisms which are already ongoing, the destabilization of the Cuban economy, its monetary system. Ultimately, the intent would be to eventually integrate the Cuban economy into the nexus of world capitalism, the IMF, the World Bank, the WTO, and so on. And that agenda is already ongoing, and it also has the support of people in high levels, and specifically it also has the support of Cuban intellectuals. So we have to look at that background. Now, I had a very specific experience when I went to Cuba the last time. The previous time I actually met with Fidel Castro and had and was invited to his home and had a long-standing conversation over 4-day period, which was subsequently published by Global Research. I should mention that Fidel was a reader of Global Research. That's how the invitation to meet him came about. He was a frequent reader of Global Research. Now, let me explain a little bit what happened.
I was invited to a conference which was sponsored by the Center for Research on International Politics, CIPI, in Spanish, Centro de Investigaciones de Política Internacional. Now that, as I said, that research center was linked to the Ministry of Foreign Affairs. And the theme of the conference was to analyze the process of geopolitical transition, opened up by the resumption of diplomatic relations between Cuba and U.S. And, of course, it was during the Obama administration. It was in October 2015. Now, let me describe what happened. I accepted to come, and then a few weeks following my acceptance, I received a message from the Hans Seidel Foundation informing me that they were supporting the conference and that they would be funding my expenses and they would also be paying me an honorarium. Now, when I got this invitation, having also worked very closely with people in Venezuela, and I, at one time I lived in Venezuela, but I was familiar with the fact that the Hans Seidel Foundation, which is linked to the right-wing Bavarian Christian Democratic Party, was, in 2012, involved in intervening in the Venezuelan presidential elections in support of Capriles Radonsky, who was running against Hugo Chavez. And they were involved in financing, in other words, they were involved in financing the Venezuelan opposition. And at the same time, I recalled various other actions of this foundation in the Ukraine, following the collapse of the Soviet Union, but also in Chile, and I became deeply concerned by the fact that an entity linked up to the Ministry of Foreign Affairs would be funded by HSS, generously funded by HSS, because there were people coming from various countries. And the intent of HSS, acting on behalf of Bavaria's CSU, which is a right-wing party, in liaison with the National Endowment for Democracy in Washington, is ultimately to undermine socialism in Cuba. And it is also consisted in an agenda of co-opting Cuban scholars and intellectuals of course, paying them honoraria in U.S. dollars or in convertible currency. And that was the background.
They offered you an honorarium.
Yeah, well, they offered me an honorarium, and they also offered to pay for my expenses, my travel, my hotel, and so on. And I sent back a note that I would cover my expenses, which created some instability in the procedures. It wasn't expected, but I wasn't going to accept any honoraria from that kind of organization. And so I paid my own expenses. Ultimately, what was more significant is the fact that the HSS was also, first of all, choosing the people who were coming to this conference, not all of them, but also it was also co-opting the Cuban scholars who were attending, all of which I presume had honoraria paid to them in one form or another. Now, what was really striking there is that, first of all, they invited people from a number of countries, including Canada, including the United States, from various countries in Latin America, Mexico, Argentina, Brazil, and so on. Not a single scholar was invited from Venezuela. Okay? That didn't surprise me, because the Hans Seidel Foundation would have said, well, invite our friends who are the dissidents, you know, which are supported now by the National Endowment for Democracy. And probably the Cubans said, no, we have to invite the Chavistas. So that nobody was invited from Venezuela. There was a panel on Venezuela. Not a single Venezuelan was there.
Who was invited?
Pardon?
Who was it? Was there any notable invitations that did show up?
No, there were no Venezuelans invited to this venue. And bearing in mind that the relationship, the political relationship between Venezuela and Cuba is very significant in terms of, you know, solidarity and so on, there was not a single Venezuelan invited. That was a decision of the German foundation, Hans Seidel Foundation. It was not a decision necessarily of the Cubans, but the Cubans accepted it ultimately. So that there we have a right-wing foundation determining the composition of who is invited, who is not invited. Now, I should say that among the Cubans, there's some very good presentations, okay? But then we had a number of rather unusual, I wasn't expecting this, at a venue by Socialist Cuba, they invited an Israeli guy who was linked up with, who was with Chatham House in the UK. Now, anybody who knows Chatham House, Royal Institute of International Affairs, knows that this is really the right wing think tank, arch reactionary British think tank, with links to the Council on Foreign Relations in Washington. And they invited Yossi Meckelberg, who came in and was discussing the Middle East. There was nobody from Syria. They could have invited people from Syria, from Palestine. No, they weren't. They invited an Israeli. And then the Israeli actually made his speech and provided a very biased interpretation of what's happening in Syria and Palestine. I won't get into the issue of the U.S. led terrorist insurgency in Syria, but what he said, he, first of all, he said it's a civil war, and then he tagged Palestinians as terrorists, okay? He also said President Bashar al-Assad was accused of killing his own people, and of course, much in line with US-UK corporate media. That was not the position of the Cuban government, which expressed its solidarity with the Syrian people. Hmm. And Meckelberg actually said that the ISS emulates the Palestinians, okay? And he says, and I'm quoting it, actually I'm quoting from another source, if at all ISS emulates the Palestinian militants, not the other way around, says Yossi Meckelberg, associate fellow at the London-based international affairs think tank Chatham House. That was the guy that the Cubans invited. Well, they didn't invite it. It was imposed by this foundation in Germany, which was footing the bill of a rather expensive venue with people from various countries, including Africa. They came from Africa, the Middle East, and so on. And then you had a couple of scholars from the Peace Institute in Vienna, who were pushing their support for the Kiev regime, which is integrated by neo-Nazis.
Svoboda and the Right Sector, right?
That's right. It just so happens that the professor was invited from the Vienna Cardiff-based Peace International Institute, who is also a member of the European Parliament. His name is Professor Hannes Svoboda. He came, and he outlined his support for U.S., NATO, and Eastern Europe, directed against Russia, as well as his endorsement of Ukraine's Maidan Kiev regime, which we know, of course, as you mentioned, is integrated by two neo-Nazi parties.
Basically, you're saying that this conference, that this October 2015 conference, which you were invited to, that's it's being financed by this HSS, which, you know, it seems kind of remarkable because this is supposed to be, you know, basically, where we go as far as, Cuba moving forward and inviting all these different scholars. It sounds vaguely reminiscent of some of the points you raised about the World Social Forum, where the Ford Foundation was involved. Are we talking about the same kind of phenomenon when you talk about this co-optation? I guess in this instance, it would be of intellectuals, I think, with World Social Forum. You're talking about co-opting movements.
The World Social Forum, it has a different structure. It really is based on a mosaic of workshops, and then and they say we must respect each other's point of view, but in effect, you might say that the same collective of corporate tax-free foundations is behind, which was behind the World Social Forum. We have the replicate here. I don't think that the Hans Seidel Foundation funds the World Social Forum. But the Ford Foundation does, or did at the outset, and there are various other key foundations which continue to fund the World Social Forum, and they belong to the same group. I mean, the Hans Seidel is one of the largest in Germany. There are others in Germany as well. The logic is the same, is to co-opt individuals and intellectuals. But you see, what was shocking in this is that when this Zionist participant invited by an institute affiliated to the Ministry of Foreign Affairs starts to bash the Palestinians and the Syrian government and the Syrian people, not a single word from the Cuban intellectuals who are there saying, "Well, listen." And then when the guy from the Peace Institute starts talking about Ukraine, they don't react, and they don't react. In fact, they don't react. And affirm that their government expressed solidarity with the people of Donbass and Crimea, okay? And in turn, the people of Donbass, the separatist province, acknowledged the solidarity with Cuba and the teachings of Fidel Castro. But the participants in this conference did not have the guts to stand up and say, "Well, Professor Svoboda, you are an apologist of U.S. NATO-led wars in Eastern Europe," okay, which is very, very, very obvious. Or stand up to the guy from Chatham House, the Zionist Israeli who came to tell them, to explain to them what's happening in the Middle East and tell them, "Well, listen." And I stood up. There's another person who had been invited, who was there, who was an Iranian, who was actually already in Cuba. He stood up and said, "Well, no, this doesn't make sense." But the thing is, there we had a debate on transition, and one had the distinct impression that some kind of new normal was being pushed in, a new consensus that somehow it was important to establish relations with Chatham House, with these institutes in Western Europe, which are linked up to U.S. NATO. And that was the tendency there. I raised this with a couple of friends at the time, and Cuban friends, and they weren't surprised because they said, no, this kind of thing is happening.
Professor Chasudovsky, we don't have a lot of time. I know there's some restrictions on your time. I was wondering if you could just maybe explain why it is so important to co-opt intellectuals in particular. I mean, I know that there's been, I mean, usually when people think of regime change, they're thinking about military in interventions of some sort, or even co-opting as just like movements, you know, colored revolutions. Where does the intellectuals fit into that?
Well, the co-opting of intellectuals is very important because intellectuals are powerful voices which people listen to. Okay, and if Cuban intellectuals start saying, well, we have to accommodate and we have to move forward and establish relations with the state of Israel, for instance, and we have to look into the possibility of restoring capitalism within certain, while preserving our societal projects, et cetera, et cetera. Well, this rings a bell. The people listen to intellectuals now, and we are also listen to intellectuals in North America now. We listen to Noam Chomsky. Well, Noam Chomsky was in favor of, is in favor of regime change in Syria. That's his opinion.
Mm.
And the left, the so-called left in North America has taken a rather ambiguous stance with regard to events in Syria. You have another prominent intellectual in Britain, Tariq Ali, who makes the same statement with regard to Syria, so that ultimately foundations manage to twist progressives into saying things which ultimately are similar to what U.S. foreign policy pundits are saying. Okay, we must get rid of Bashar al-Assad. Well, if they say that, it's very powerful. So if a Cuban intellectual says, well, we should maybe have diplomatic relations with Israel, or we must interchange with we must look into the issues of Palestine in a particular way. This has a bearing, and of course, ultimately, what is at stake is really, will the Cuban social project, revolutionary project, survive? And I'm not very optimistic because ultimately, the whole monetary structure is very, very unstable with dual currencies. On that same visit, I met up with friends from the University of Havana, and they said to me, "We have shortage of paper. Paper is rationed in the classrooms." And publication of books is now at a standstill. So some very serious disruptions are occurring within the whole, economic system to make those things happen. The underfunding of universities, the underfunding of schools, something which didn't exist historically in Cuba. Inroads into the healthcare system, and so on, and eventually inroads into the system of consumer rationing, which would ultimately lead the Cubans into a situation of poverty and social inequality.
Okay. I know you've got to go almost right away, but I know that I just wanted to mention that you'll be speaking in Winnipeg on Monday the 15th on the North Korea crisis, and then in Vancouver on the 16th. And is there anything you'd like to – I mean, I'm just kind of curious to see if there's a quick comparison that could be made between Cuba and North Korea to, you know, at least in terms of U.S. Designs.
Well, the objective of the United States in on the Korean Peninsula is twofold. One, it's to destroy socialism in North Korea. North Korea is a buffer state. It has borders with Russia and China. But the ultimate objective of the threats and the possibility of war with North Korea, the ultimate objective is China and Russia. It's the threat, as I said, the real threat is not, or let me put it differently, the objective of the geopolitical objective of Washington is not necessarily to destroy North Korea. It ultimately views North Korea as a stepping stone against China. That is, I think, something which is absolutely crucial. But if we start to compare North Korea to Cuba, the logic of socialism in North Korea is fundamentally different because they're completely cut off from the capitalist economy, and consequently they've been able to build their economy based on self-reliance. Cuba is in exactly the opposite situation. It is increasingly integrated into worldwide capitalism, and it has for many, many years. And at the same time, the fabric of Cuban society is currently in crisis, and there are large sectors, I think, of Cuban, particularly, and we mentioned intellectuals, which favor some kind of capitalist restoration. And in fact, it would appear that this capitalist restoration is almost de facto, despite the broad commitments that the Cubans have to sustaining the Cuban Revolution.
Professor Chossadovsky, I'll let you go now. I appreciate your time, and I definitely look forward to these upcoming talks of yours. So, you know, and enjoy the rest of your week.
Thank you very much.
That was Michel Chossadovsky, founder and director of the Center for Research on Globalization. Professor Chossadovsky will be speaking to audiences in two Canadian cities about the situation in North Korea and the prospects of an escalation into a nuclear conflict. He speaks in Winnipeg on Monday, January 15th from 2:30 to 4 p.m. at 237 University College at the University of Manitoba. Then in the evening from 7 to 9 p.m., Professor Chossadovsky speaks at the University of Winnipeg's Eckhart Gramité Hall on the third floor of Centennial Hall, the main campus building. On Tuesday, January 16th, Professor Chossadovsky speaks in Vancouver Public Library Central Branch at 350 West Georgia Street, starting at 7 p.m. Admission is free for all three events, but donations are welcome. For details, visit globalresearch.ca. Arnold August will be speaking in Winnipeg's McNally Robinson Booksellers in the atrium on Thursday, January 18th, starting at 7 p.m. on the topic of Cuba-U.S. relations from Obama to Trump. Admission is free. You've been listening to the Global Research News Hour. You can listen to our programs every week on CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg and on partnering radio stations across Canada and the United States. We are now also broadcast on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. You can also download each episode from the website globalresearch.ca. To leave feedback on this program, email globalresearchnewshour@gmail.com. I'm series host, creator, and producer Michael Welch. Join us again next week. Listeners take note. Juan Carlos Rodriguez Diaz, a distinguished Cuban professor, researcher, historian, and politician, and a member of the National Assembly of People's Power in Cuba, will be speaking at various locations across Canada between now and April 5th. On Saturday, March 31st, he will speak in Winnipeg at 7 p.m. at 360 Osborne Street in the Multipurpose Room. Then on Tuesday, April 3rd, at 7 p.m., he will speak in Vancouver at the Vancouver Public Library Central Branch at 340 West Georgia Street. Finally, on Wednesday, April 4th, at 7 p.m. local time, Señor Rodriguez Diaz will appear in Victoria at 2994 Douglas in the BCGEU Hall. For more details, visit CanadianNetworkOnCuba.ca and follow the link at Parliamentarian Tour.